It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here to introduce Anna, who, as they say, needs no introduction. The last time I was in this room for a concert, it was actually a celebratory concert for Eleonora Sivan, who was one of Anna's teachers, a primary teacher, and very relevant to Anna's terrific theme this evening, which is piano lessons, which we'll have her reading, talking, and playing the piano. But I mean, Anna is very well known to anyone who attends classical music concerts, both in her own right as a solo pianist and also with the Seraphim Trio, which she founded with two others, obviously, over 20 years ago, very successfully. They've performed ever since, to the great joy of all of us. But Anna is extraordinarily diverse in her talents. She's produced a libretto for The Magic Pudding, which I presume is a comic opera, though I suppose there's tragic potential in the unconsummatable relationship between Sam Sornoff and Bill Barnacle. But that's just one of many things she's done. She's written the book, which is part of tonight's performance. She's written a quarterly essay, another book of essays, and is appearing at the Cabaret Festival this year in October, which is, I don't know if it's a new departure, but it was certainly new to me when I read about it. With all these talents, we're very fortunate, Anna, that we have Anna here tonight, and you don't want to listen to me anymore. I just ask Anna to perform. Thank you.
Thank you, Oliver. Can you hear me okay at the back? It's lovely to be here tonight, lovely to see a few familiar faces in the audience, and particularly lovely, I think, to be talking mostly about this book, Piano Lessons, in the place from which it sprang. You know, this very Hartley Concert Room was a kind of key venue in my musical upbringing, and so it's lovely to sort of bring it back home, this story. So I'll be talking mostly about my first book tonight, actually exclusively about my first book tonight, and that's Piano Lessons, which came out now 6 years ago. And my publisher was joking with me the other day. He was saying, all you need to do now is get an action figure, because it sort of spawned a number of spin-offs. I recorded a CD. I converted it into a stage play that many of you, or some of you, may have been to at the Adelaide Cabaret Festival this year and elsewhere. I've toured with that quite a lot. There's now an audiobook, a reasonably recent release. It's an audiobook, which is a version of recordings I made of this book for ABC Radio National some years ago. And I've also sold the film rights. So it's sort of the gift that keeps on giving, this book, for me in many ways. And I think in a lot of sort of deeper ways too, beyond the kind of external measurables. It's a book that's had a really profound impact on my own thinking and my own understanding of my art, but also I think my relationship with my teacher and indeed my life. So tonight I'd like to talk a little bit about the genesis of the project, about some of the challenges that confronted me in the writing of it, and a couple of sort of side issues as well that are of some relevance. So a bit of personal background, first of all. When I was 9 years old, my grandfather took me to audition for a new piano teacher. And that was one of the defining moments of my childhood. I'm quite convinced that I wouldn't have become a musician if I hadn't fronted up at the house of Eleonora Sivan, inflicted my Mozart piano sonata upon her, and had me essentially take me under her wing, I think partly out of sympathy. She said, a nine-year-old girl who tries so hard, surely she deserves to learn. My own motivations for wanting to learn the piano were somewhat different. As a child, I was obsessed by Young Talent Time, and my mother had correctly told me that I didn't have a chance of going on it as a singer, which was a little bit rough in retrospect. However, it was brutally honest, and so piano lessons seemed like my only opportunity. But that's where I began. But later, as I grew up throughout my childhood and certainly throughout my adolescence, the piano came to mean much more to me. It provided me, I think, with a type of faith in a way, and certainly with an identity. And at the same time, it challenged me and continues to challenge me probably more than just about anything else in my life. Now, Eleonora Sivan herself, Oliver mentioned that he'd been here, I think it was last year we were speaking about Eleonora Sivan. Some of her students were making a presentation about the nature of her teaching. And she has a sort of fascinating backstory that I don't explore in a great deal of depth in the book, because the book is very much in first person and a sort of highly subjective account of my relationship with her from childhood up. But she had been a lecturer at the Leningrad Conservatorium, what was then Leningrad, of course it's now St. Petersburg again. And as a very small child, she'd been a protege of Shostakovich, and she used to play his children's pieces for other composers. And he was a great formative influence in her life, and she still speaks of him truly reverently. She said he's one of the few people she's ever seen who could walk into a room and you just physically couldn't remain seated. You had to stand up out of respect for this great human being. She left Leningrad with her family, and they sort of floated around Europe for a few years, and they decided to move to Australia, but they essentially ended up in Adelaide by mistake. They were planning to go to Melbourne, and she found herself at the Pennington Hostel on one of those truly insufferable... Can you hear me still at the back? Is this okay? One of those truly insufferable Adelaide summer days. You can't. Okay, I wonder if I can raise this up a bit. Thank you. Is that a bit better? Great. So yes, they arrived in Adelaide on one of those truly insufferable hot Adelaide summer days. It was 40 plus degrees. And she's a person of great resilience and optimism. But she said on this occasion, she just lay down in her bed and she thought, my life is over. But fortunately, her husband, Isaac, is quite resourceful. And he was able to catch, I think, a bus into the city centre. And he came home. And he said to her, he said, I have very good news. Adelaide is not just little village, but decent medium-sized town. He said, definitely we can make a life here. And it really sort of moves me now when I think about how they did make a life here, how they just arrived with nothing and they built. And she taught piano students, those students became teachers, and she sort of spawned a whole school of not just piano teaching, but music making, and a particular philosophy, a particular artistic and indeed life philosophy that to some extent I tried to articulate in this book. I might just, to give you a little bit of insight into the force of nature that is Mrs. Sivan, I might just read you an excerpt about my very first encounter with her when my grandfather took me to her house for an audition. At this point, we arrive at our destination, my grandfather intoned, as we pulled up outside a cream brick bungalow, the home of the distinguished Mrs. Eleonora Sivan, formerly of the Leningrad Conservatorium of Music. At the front door, there were courtly nods and handshakes all round, and my grandfather and mother speaking too loudly. And how are you enjoying your new house, Mrs. Sivan? My grandfather asked. Yes, we like enormous. Much more comfortable than Pennington Hostel. They all laughed and I dared look up. How to describe her? In my mind, she is less a character than a force. Music is coiled inside her under a pressure that demands expression. And from the moment she opened the door, she did not stop talking. I might add that continuous stream of talk hasn't stopped in the 30 years since. It's still going. She must have been in her 40s. But she was not much taller than my 9-year-old self, and she had the peachy, springy skin of an infant. She still does, actually, in her 70s. I met her powerful gaze and blushed and dropped my eyes. We are not teaching piano playing, she said. Her English was new, and I was not sure if I'd heard correctly. We are teaching philosophy and life and music digested. Music is yours. Instrument is you are. Come in, please come in. She ushered us into her living room and directed me to an ancient upright piano with yellowing keys. Music is logically created fantasy, she continued. When I give information, this information comes to student to digest. When digestion coming, the nutrition is his own, it's not mine. I scanned the room, searching for something of the known world to which I could anchor myself. The piano was pushed against a wall painted a lurid metallic pink, In the middle of this wall, there was a calendar, and I pinned my hopes on this. What is the result of a clever, clever heart and a very kind and generous brain? I stared at my mother, willing her to answer, but she avoided my gaze. It is clever hands, Mrs. Sivan declared. Indeed it is, said my grandfather. Now, I imagine you'd like to hear Anna play her Mozart sonata. Of course, please, make yourself comfortable. Always think first of music and not to impress us. And never start until you are ready. This is first arts of any music. Learn to listen to silence, atmospheric silence. Only then can we understand future and perspective. So these words about philosophy and life and music digested went a little bit over my nine-year-old head. But they were words that I sort of grew to understand over the years that followed. And I think the words I sought to, explain over the course of this book. At our very first lesson, and I'll read this excerpt now just because I think it's relevant to another point I'd like to make a little bit later on. She took me through the hands and explained a particular personality type of every finger. I did this to my six-year-old the other day, and he found it actually quite compelling. Let us talk about the fingers, Mrs. Sivan said. This finger, the pointer finger, is good student. This third finger is, what you say, reliable. But this finger, oi. She shook her head. Fourth finger, very lazy. Her words were picturesque, but to me they were entirely abstract. Over the years, my body came to understand them for me. It is the thumb that makes a pianist, she said, and showed me what the thumb can do, her hands fluttering over the keyboard, kneading at it, producing sounds of striking intensity. Then she took my little finger into her hand. It is the little finger that makes an artist. She winked her little finger at me, demonstrating its independence, like waving to a friend. Bye-bye. The first composer we began work on was Bach, and I still think you can't go past this as a place to begin your daily routine. You know, Schumann said, make Bach your daily bread and you will surely become a fine musician. And I find with just about any student, regardless of their background, Bach is just a really wonderful place to start our own lessons. So we began work on Bach's, on that classic Australian volume based on the Anna Magdalena notebook called The Children's Spark, edited by E. Harold Davies, which I think was a part of many a musical childhood and certainly a large part of mine. She said, Bach basically is father of all music. He has huge influence on everybody. He was educator of Chopin, of Beethoven, of Schumann, and even all modern jazz already here. You can try anything and Bach already do it. Of course, Bach never knew piano. Why not? Piano not yet invented. I glanced dubiously at my father, who gave an emphatic nod. But piano, absolute instrument of imagination, and we can create anything on it. Remember always that Bach represents God in this world, with his wisdom, his acceptance, his forgiveness. Like he always bless you. I've already learnt that minuet, I told her, imagining it was possible to complete a piece. I finished it with my old teacher. Ah, Bach is never finished. Life in this music, endless. She took my finger and dived with it into the key. It plunged to the bottom with the precise weight of a ball bearing. And here, very harpsichord touch. What Bach gives? Peace, of course, and bells. So here is one of the minuets from the Anna Magdalena notebook in G major. It may not have actually been written by Bach, but he certainly put it in his little handwritten book that he put together for his second wife.
Thank you.
our lessons, we moved through the small preludes and the Anna Magdalena notebook to the inventions and sinfonias and eventually to the preludes and fugues. Mrs. Sivan took me through each part repeatedly, considering the intention of each note, the attraction that bound it to its neighbours. It was not enough just to play each part, to feel it in my hands. I had to sing it in my head, follow its contour, tell its story. Then, when I put the parts together, by a sudden miracle, I could hear them all at once. It was as though I had three minds or three sets of ears operating in parallel. The first time this happened, I turned to her, astonished. My consciousness had expanded. I could feel air rushing into unused parts of my mind. "Exactly," she said. "Otherwise, we'll be awful." So this is the prelude and fugue in C-sharp major from book one of the Well-Tempered Clavier of Bach. I might talk about this a little bit here because we're in a South Australian literary context, and this was about the fact that my dad, Peter Goldsworthy, is also a writer, And he used to take every Tuesday afternoon off work to accompany me to my lessons, and did this for many years over the course of my childhood and right until I finished school. So he was terribly devoted in that sense, but he was also very, very inspired by Mrs. Sivan in his own right. And when I was a teenager, he always used to show me what he was working on. I used to proofread it for him. And one Saturday morning, shortly after I'd started lessons with Mrs. Sivan, so maybe I was about 10 or 11, I wandered into his study. "I've got something to show you," he said. And he scrolled to the top of a document on his old Macintosh 128. "Have a look at this pie." And this is from the manuscript. He waggled a forefinger in front of my nose. It was our second lesson, our third. "This finger is selfish, greedy, a delinquent. He will steal from his four friends, cheat, lie." He sheathed the fourth finger in his closed fist as if it were the fleshy blade of a Swiss Army knife and released the middle finger. "Mr. Goody Goody," he said, banging the finger down on middle C repeatedly. "Teacher's pet, does what he's told, our best student." Last came the ring finger. "Likes to follow his best friend," he told me. "Likes to lean on him sometimes." He lifted his elbows upwards and outwards. "Those are the pupils. This is the teacher, the elbow." "You can't do this," I cried out. I knew he drew from life in his writing, but this was worse. It was robbery. "Have you even asked Mrs. Sivan?" "Don't worry, Pi. I'll show it to her when I finish it. If I finish it." People are usually flattered to inspire books. I ran out to the back garden to tell my mother. She let the lawnmower idle for a moment as she listened, squinting at me under her sun visor. "Deary, deary, deary me," she said, and then revved up the machine and finished her mowing. So over the next few months, I sort of attended Mrs. Sivan's lessons with this sort of terrible conscience that I was part of this clandestine spying operation that was informing the book that went on to become my father's first novel, Maestro. But the character, for those of you who've read the book, the character Edward Keller is sort of inspired by the language of our lessons, and in fact his sort of catch cry is something that Mrs. Sivan always said, which is, what is the difference between a good and a great pianist? A little bit. And yet, as a character, he's entirely different to Mrs. Sivan, to Eleonora. He's an Austrian, he's an alcoholic, he lives in Darwin, and he's somewhat sort of a misanthrope, whereas Mrs. Sivan, Eleonora, is very warm, obviously very much the opposite as a person, and actually was not at all resentful when Dad showed her the manuscript, as far as I know, even though I had been quite fearful. Somewhere later on in the book, I think I said... In passing, I said something like, "My father cannibalised my childhood for his writing," and that was like holding up a red flag to a bull in terms of the critical response and the questions that came to me, and whether this was an act of revenge, an act of sort of reclaiming my own childhood. And even Eleonora said to me, she said she wondered whether there was an element of competition in my writing this book. I didn't think there was, I certainly didn't feel there was on a conscious level. But, I guess that brings me to the question of why did I write it, particularly given all my scruples about my father in using this material to write. So it's probably a bit ironic that I went ahead and did the same. I'd always sort of thought I might write about her, because I've always loved writing, and I'd always thought I might write about her sometime. But I kind of imagined it would be something I might do after I sort of retired from being a pianist myself in my twilight years. I got an email, I guess probably 7 or 8 years ago now, on my birthday, coincidentally enough, from an editor at Black Ink, which is a terrific Melbourne publishing house, Chris Fike. And he'd read a few essays I'd written for the Monthly, and he asked whether I might consider writing a memoir about the piano playing life. He said you could call it Piano Lessons, so I can't even take credit for the title or the idea. But when I got the email at first, I thought, no, of course I can't do this. It seems sort of terribly presumptuous. I was a bit younger than I am now, and I felt I was still very much an apprentice, despite the fact that I'd been playing for 25 years. But gradually I came around to the idea for a number of reasons. It occurred to me that writing such a book might allow me to clarify my own thinking about music, to systemize it into some kind of containable form, and it absolutely did do that. But beyond that, it struck me that it could be a great way to honor Eleonora, because having a teacher like this is an enormous privilege, but it also at times can feel like quite a heavy responsibility when they invest so much in you, as much as she invested in me over the years, hours upon hours. You know, you have a clear sense that you have to somehow, I suppose, pay that forward to your own generation of students. But also, I was just keen for some of her really beautiful ideas to be disseminated further. Because these are ideas that are not only about piano, and they're not even only about music, they're kind of life lessons. And the piano lessons, or the life lessons, I guess, with the book's title, come from her. But they also come from just the discipline and the travails of embarking on this type of artistic pursuit. And it fascinated me when this book first came out, the great range of responses I got from various people. And I got a lovely email from a poet I know, saying he thought it was a sort of really definitive version of the lacerating nature of artistic pursuit. And that's an aspect of it too. There's a lot of sort of wounds, I think, and I'm sure this is true of any profession, but certainly they're quite often quite public humiliations and wounds in the artistic field or the performance field. So those lessons can be absolutely lessons of humility, but they're also lessons of joy, I think. These are the lessons she gave me of love, of generosity. Her sort of philosophy is that all of this music, or most of the greatest music, does stem from some fundamental generous human impulse. You know, it is actually about celebrating our common humanity. And to get up in my soapbox for a minute, I think these themes are particularly important in today's world, where I often fear we're in danger of giving all of this away. And certainly, and I've just been writing an extended essay about this for the monthly, what I perceive is a kind of dismantling of cultural traditions and the humanistic tradition all around us. And I think it's a very beautiful thing that needs to be protected for all sorts of reasons, including, and it's terribly unfashionable to say this, but including the values that's at the core of this great art, that are at the core. But also another lesson that was administered at times somewhat brutally was a lesson in gratitude. So there were times over the course of this story in which I think, you know, my head got a little bit swollen and I wasn't quite as grateful as perhaps I should be. And there's a particularly painful scene in this, which occurred after I'd completed my schooling. I'd completed year 12 and I'd got a perfect score for my year 12 exams, and I'd got the Tennyson Medal and the Don Maynard Prize for music. And I think I thought I was pretty damn good at the time. And then I was interviewed by the Advertiser. It was my first sort of brush with, you know, a small measure of fame. And I mentioned Eleonora's name, but I didn't make a big deal out of it. And I mentioned that my kindergarten teacher had taught me how to read. And when the article came out the following morning, it said something like, and I also said I was thinking of moving to Sydney. And so this article came out and it said, Anna plans to move to Sydney to seek fame and fortune as a concert pianist. And she attributes all of her success to her kindergarten teacher who taught her how to read. And so I received a very unhappy phone call from a person who taught me rather more than that, and you know, went over and saw her, and we kind of had it out. But it was quite painful to revisit that scene. It was something I'd sort of tucked away, and I guess this is the kind of excavating process of writing a memoir. But I got through it. I wrote it in the privacy of the little room I was working in when I wrote this book. I was living in Melbourne. At Janet Clark Hall, one of the university colleges. But then after it came out and I was asked by Deborah Conway, the singer-songwriter Deborah Conway, who was then directing the Queensland Music Festival, to convert it into a stage play, I then had to dramatise that scene and I then had to act in it. And so it's a very sort of bizarre form of therapy, acting in a play about your own life, revisiting these really awkward, uncomfortable and at times quite mortifying moments from your past. And we've toured quite a lot with that play. It's not necessarily a form of therapy I'd recommend to everybody, but it is in a way quite exercising. So, the other curious thing I think about writing a memoir is the nature of the reviews you get. People started reviewing my life. And my life got varying reviews. I had certain reviews that were sort of envious and a little bit resentful. And then I had other reviews that were quite sort of full of pity for this poor child who was clearly deprived of childhood. And so it's sort of a very strange experience reading reviews of your own past. But I guess that's an occupational hazard of writing a memoir. So I enjoyed writing this book, but it sort of became more problematic as I moved through those difficulties in adolescence. And there are certain lines that I wrote, again, that you can write, that, you know, I write about the awkwardness of turning into an adolescent, and you can write these things and sort of have a private chuckle to yourself. But then being forced to, like, there's a line in which I say, I'd always been tall. I'm talking about how I'd become very unbeautiful. And it said, I think it's something like, my body had been, seemed to have been disassembled and put back together in a very strange way. My face had been vandalised with acne. I'd always been tall, but now I'd become outrageously tall, well beyond the limits of good taste. And, you know, you can write that, but then when it gets turned into a play and you're standing up on stage outrageously tall and telling everybody that you're outrageously tall, it's a really kind of confusing situation to be in. But I do think a memoir only has value if you are probably prepared to take self-revelation to that that extra step. It's something I feel a little bit conflicted about, because I feel on the one hand we're terribly self-revealing today in all sorts of ways. It's a property of Facebook culture. Everyone's out there all the time. And yet there are things that we often choose not to admit to ourselves. And sometimes I think the most compelling memoir writing, and also by extension actually, some of the most writing that I've found, fiction that I've found most compelling in recent years has been Karlof Knausgaard or more recently Elena Ferrante. And there is a sense that either of them will go anywhere. They won't spare themselves anything, nor will they spare the people around them anything. And that's where it all gets a bit awkward and problematic. But I might speak about that a little bit after I've played something else. To give you a sort of sense of the nature of the teaching as we sort of move beyond Bach, I thought I might jump forward to Liszt. And this is a key moment. This was a key moment in my musical upbringing. It was my first recital. I don't know if you remember, Edmund Wright House used to be used by the Australian Society of Keyboard Music for recitals, and that was the location of my very first recital. So I'm very grateful to that society for everything they did to support young artists over the years. Now, where are we? I have a complicated paperclip system here. Okay. I had to work out what to play at my first recital. "For lunch recital must be very special program," she said. "Bach, Mozart, Chopin etudes, yes, but must be something more." "Of course." Her eyes lit up. "Liszt Rigoletto paraphrase. You will do beautifully. Absolute freedom and fantasy. Tells story of Verdi's opera and brings it to life in piano." She disappeared into her music library, returning with a score. "We talk about generosity. Liszt, completely generous musician and completely open. I admire this man more and more. Very interesting how enormously educated he was. Czerny was his teacher, which meant he had Beethoven roots straight away. But also he learns from everything and everybody, happy to give and happy to take. Sometimes takes from Chopin, by the way, who not always so generous, except to piano, who he loves. Liszt understands that poetry, literature, opera, ballet, all coming from the piano and to the piano. The richer you are like a person in knowledge and imagination, the more what? The more you can give, I guessed. Exactly, because the more you have in your store." She put the music on the stand and turned to the first page. I thrilled to the sight of the opening left-hand octaves. "Liszt, very philosophical composer and busy always with three questions, love, life, and death. What is negative and what is positive? How much wrong do we have in our right? It depends on situation and place." "Of course," I said, imagining myself playing those octaves at a lunchtime recital. "Devil and God, kindness, generosity, and nastiness always was subject for a lot of musicians, the same as in literature, only in sounds. I reached for the keyboard, but she caught my hand without pausing. Here we have opera, full story, with real characters. Rigoletto is basically clown, how do you say, jester, and tragic figure, really. And his daughter, Gilda, completely innocent. And then we have the Duke, professional at seduction. We begin with philosophical introduction from Liszt, not from Verdi. She stopped me when I came to the second page. Not, by the way, is a bit of a catch cry. Not. Duke must be seductive, otherwise we have no problem. She laughed. No story, everybody can go home. I know it's difficult, you are a 15-year-old girl, more Gilda than Duke, really. But to tell this story, you must be everything. Gilda and Rigoletto and Maddalena and conductor and orchestra and Duke and director and a million other things. Liszt always very interested in seduction, Mrs. Sivan continued. He believes you can seduce near everyone. Without our knowledge, we can be under a spell, and this always fascinates Liszt. If Mephistopheles put his real face on everything, of course, we know to avoid him. But when he is a charming man who says beautiful things, then you have no idea. Here, we start with left hand, like serenade. She plucked at the accompaniment, which floated through the air like a guitar. And now we choose our tenor. You like Pavarotti? She performed the melody for me as Pavarotti, each sound swollen with emotion. Or perhaps you prefer Placido Domingo. She played it again, this time more smoothly, and laughed. Possibilities endless. Liszt understands seduction very well. Absolutely everybody was in love with him. She dropped her voice. Excuse me for saying, but you big girl now. Liszt was a womanizer, natural. But more than this, he was seducer of audiences. In this way, he was opposite to Chopin, who hated big stage. Liszt was inspired by Paganini on violin, by enormous possibilities of virtuosity, to excite, to thrill. People go crazy, women faint. Sometimes it seems beyond human, even like devil power. Liszt's pianism is a sort of magic arts. So I hesitate after such an introduction to try to play, but this is Liszt's Rigoletto paraphrase.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we might be up to question time. Does that sound about right? Have I timed this about right? Are there any questions?
Is it possible to hit the wrong note or and so wired through your brain?
It's terribly possible. The question was, is it possible to hit a wrong note? Or are you so wired? It's terribly possible. It's terrifyingly possible. And I sort of was most keenly aware of this. I think I took a few months off performing with the birth of my first child. And the first time I stepped back onto the stage, I just had a sense of the risk, again, a renewed sense of the risk of the fact that in any particular situation, there's one note that's right and there's all these inviting notes everywhere else that is wrong. And I think I think if it became too easy or too perfect, maybe that edge of uncertainty or risk might be lost. And I know you can play it safe in performance. You can play it safe and aim for a hugely accurate and a technically precise reading, and we all obviously aspire towards accuracy, but to my mind, one of the problematic legacies of recording was this new expectation on performers of perfectibility, and sometimes perfectibility, I think, is the enemy of art. Maybe I'm quoting someone in that. I don't know. Any other questions? Yes.
Do you think that live performances are wonderful to tell you, even if it's supposed to be perfect recordings? And I'm wondering if you think that element of risk somehow gets translated into a live performance of energy.
Yeah, I also am a great believer in the live recording, and I know there are some people who are real connoisseurs of recordings, and obviously I love recordings because it gives us all access to the greats of the past and people who we might not readily get to hear otherwise. But there is something to me about almost a sort of the sacred space of the concert hall. It can be a terribly sort of moribund space as well. If you go to a boring concert and if everyone's sort of so concerned with protocol, sometimes I think that can actually kill the music. But when you go to a great concert and there's such a sense of the vitality of the composer after possibly centuries, the vitality of the performer, your common humanity, and also just the very special thing of sitting in a room of silent, attentive people immersed in a type of collective meditation on the nature of being a human being, that's a precious thing to me, I think. And, you know, it's about attention, it's about stillness, it's about silence. These are very, very rare commodities in our lives today. So to me, the concert space is as important a space as ever.
You mentioned you sold the film rights. My question is, how much control do you have the film rights?
Yes, how much control? This is it's a tricky question, actually, because when I sold them, the filmmaker said to me, look, I can't offer you the power of veto, because if you have that, it makes it much harder to secure funding if everybody thinks that the author might suddenly, you know, have a tantrum and pull back. So it's very much a trust thing. And the filmmaker I sold the rights to is Anna Kokonos, who every film she's made previously, and I don't know if you're familiar with her body of work, but you know, she's a wonderful artist, but has always been very attracted to very, very dark subject matter. Her most famous film, I think, was Head On. And so it was sort of a counterintuitive thing to say to her, here's my book, which is in so many ways about the loveliness of this music. But she kind of sold it to me. She was very passionate about it. And when I sold her the rights, you know, she had a concept of it as sort of unfolding as a kind of continuous soundtrack of Mrs. Sivan's words and the music. And she said she thinks it's both intimate, it's about hands, it's about the piano, and it's also epic. And anyway, she kind of won me over. And she said to me, it's about trust. You have to trust me. So I have trusted her. I don't know if anything will come of it or not. But in terms of who I'd like to play myself, gosh, I don't know. I'm sure I can think of a lot of very flattering possibilities, and I doubt it will be any of them. Yes, Chris.
I wonder if you could say something about having music education offered to all schools,
mm-hmm.
or just to those children who appear to be gifted or elite.
Yeah.
I gather in Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
Eastern European countries, it's expected that every child...
Absolutely. In Finland, it's actually mandated in government policy that every child is entitled not just to an music education, but a good music education. And the whole education system in Finland has been exemplary, obviously highly expensive, but really exemplary in terms of their international results. There is so much research now that it just sort of makes you want to tear your hair out about how a music education for a child, we're not talking about creating a generation of performers, we're not even talking about renewing audiences, which is one of my own personal concerns. I have a vested interest in having a continuing audience, obviously, but we're not even talking about that. There is so much research that indicates that the best thing you can do for a child, according to just about any criteria you can imagine, is give them a music education. It will improve their numeracy, it will improve their literacy, it will improve their brain's executive ability. Bizarrely, it will improve their social skills. It improves everything, and yet we just have no leadership about this, and we haven't for such a long time. And there's a generation of kids who are missing out on it. The kids who are getting the good music educations are the kids who go to the private schools. And so then it just perpetuates the stereotype of music being something that's elite, when I think this culture should be offered to everybody. They won't all necessarily run with it or devote their lives to it, but it's opening doors, and more importantly, it's opening doors within their minds. So it's something I feel very passionate about.
Well, I completely agree, but personally I'd add foreign languages and maths to that. And we're all prejudiced in different ways. I just like to bring it down to earth and say that Don Bradman played the piano as well as cricket. He didn't play it as well as he played cricket, or indeed as well as you do, but he was once asked, you know, can you explain how you fit into cricket? And he said, well, cricket's Beethoven and I'm just another pianist.
Well, that's gorgeous.
We've listened to somebody who's not just another pianist, and I think it helps to understand what Don Bradman was trying to get at about any wonderful skill that somebody might have. Music, of course, is much more than cricket, but I think we've gained some insight into what music education is, how you live with music, how you grow with music, and many other fine things. And I hope everybody's going to immediately buy the book and buy the CDs and go to the Cabaret Festival and go to when Anna is touring with the Seraphim Trio. And here is a small but inadequate gift.
Thank you.
South Australians.